Representative Hillstrom, welcome to committee. Do you want to present your bill and your testifiers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I also do have an A1 amendment that I know we'll have to move after we have a quorum, but it just simply deletes an amount of money in setting a cap. It simplifies the sentence.
Okay. Well, we'll wait to act on your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1904 requires a report to the legislature on community dispute resolution programs. It alters the requirements for community dispute program grants and appropriates money for these grants. And with me today is Beth Bailey Allen. She's the executive director from Community Mediation Services. And if I could turn it over to her.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chairman Kinnear and members. Thank you for this opportunity to speak on behalf of House File 1904 in support of community mediation centers. I'm Beth Bailey Allen of Maple Grove and the Executive Director of Community Mediation Services, one of seven centers in Minnesota. I'd like to take 3 minutes to provide some historical context for the bill. In the 1970s, mediation was being introduced across the country in a variety of venues as people were seeking alternative methods for resolving disputes and preventing violence. It didn't take long for people in local communities to see the potential of this new method of common sense method for resolving a variety of disputes quickly and without violence. By 1983, Minnesota had 4 community mediation centers. These centers are formed around 2 core beliefs. First, whether among students, divorcing parents, coworkers, consumers, neighbors, victims and offenders, we believe that people are capable of resolving their own disputes in a nonviolent, effective, and sustainable manner through mediation. Second, we believe in the volunteer capacities of our communities. By 1987, the list of community centers grew to 5, and the Minnesota legislature became involved by establishing guidelines, and then in 1990, by appropriating $110,000 to be shared among Minnesota's emerging community mediation centers. Among other things, those guidelines required us to provide statistical reports, and we have done so for 20 years. It's our understanding that you have never seen our report. So one of the alterations to the language is so that that information will get to you, and you will know what's happening, and we are accountable to you for that money. Fast forward 20 years, we now have 7 centers sharing that same pot of money established with $1,990. Mediation is recognized nationally as an effective tool to prevent and reduce violence, and the demand for services grows. For example, the Brooklyn Center Mediation Project, founded in 1983, handled 29 cases in that first year. In this past year, we served over 1,700 cases with over 100 volunteer mediators. Like many of our counterparts here today, Community Mediation Services has grown from a single city organization to a regional organization stretching from Brooklyn Center to now. While we are proud to be embraced by our communities and grateful for an unlimited supply of volunteer mediators willing to do this work, we are painfully aware of the fact that the legislature's allocation has dropped from 50% of our financial support to 10%. We have seen 2 centers fold in recent years, one suburban and one rural. We watch new programs struggling to get up and running, entire regions of Minnesota lacking access, and the metro programs turning away potential volunteers due to declining staff resources. Conflict is hard. It often brings out the worst in people. However, for the last 25 years, we have seen that if you provide people with a chance to be heard, to be treated with dignity, and to own their own outcomes, conflict can bring out the best in people. We've established a very effective and inexpensive model for reducing violence and for delivering an important community resource that addresses problems that otherwise become burdens on our public resources. Across the state, there are people who are willing to donate their time as volunteer mediators, and there are people who are struggling with conflict. We need to boost the investment in the infrastructure that brings together volunteers and disputants. In 1987 and 1990, the legislature stepped into unknown waters and made out what turned out to be a very wise investment. We are asking you to believe in the capacity of community volunteers and in the capacity of Minnesotans to resolve disputes peacefully and update that investment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey Allen. Do you provide services to families who have family violence orders for protection taken out against them? Or?
Many of our clients are families who have high levels of conflict, and we resolve disputes around parenting time, runaway issues, but once there is domestic violence as part of a history of family dynamic, we do not provide mediation services. We guide them to other resources that we are connected with in our community.
Okay. Thank you. Do you want to make some testimony?
I do. Thank you, Karen.
You can just do it briefly.
Yes. My name is Denise Clint, and I'm from Southeast Minnesota Mediation Services in Rochester. I'm a representative of one of those new programs struggling to get up and running. The way our funding is right now is a fixed pot of money, relatively small amount, $107, $110, that gets divided among all the community mediation programs in the state. So every time a new program is added, it takes away from the pot of money of the existing programs, and that's one of the problems. There's not much incentive to encourage new communities to have these programs because it just ends up taking away the pot of money that already exists. I've been very lucky that my colleagues in the other programs have been very generous with their time and with expertise, but it's been a big problem. I'm the only person working in the Rochester office, and I work 20 hours a week. And I get calls not only from Rochester and all the surrounding communities, but as far away as Mankato and Winona. And it's, of course, with one person doing executive director intake scheduling at 20 hours a week, it's very hard to provide services to the people that need it. I'm very constrained in what I can do just from the lack of ability to fund not only a permanent position but any staff to help. And we have I have colleagues from Austin and Northfield also that have very small offices. In Austin we have South Mediation Center of Southern Minnesota, and in Northfield we have Rice County Dispute Resolution Program, but we're the only outstate programs right now, and all of us have encountered people from other rural outstate communities that would like to start programs, but there's really no funding and no incentive to do so right now in the system. And that's one thing we would like to solve, because community mediation services are so important in the prevention aspect of so many issues, landlord-tenant issues that could end up, you know, in 911 or police calls. I even had an employer-employee dispute that the police ended up being called. They were able to resolve that through mediation, and I doubt that will ever happen again. But it's so important to be able to provide those services to prevent problems before they start. And it would be nice if we could have parity throughout Minnesota where everybody would have that available to them. And one thing I just wanted to quickly mention is the financial aspect of this. There was an article in the Police Chief magazine, a national magazine, Police Chief, July 2006, talking about cost-effective crime prevention programs and strategies. And the first area they mention under that of cost-effective prevention is settling disputes without violence through mediation. And for example, the statistics they had were from Durham, North Carolina, and they found that cases handled through mediation cost $72, and those cases, if they went through the court system, cost $186. So you multiply that savings times the number of cases that we have right now in Minnesota, which is thousands, and that's quite a savings to the justice system, and that's why we really think that this is it's a request of money now, but we haven't had funds an increase since 1990, so I think it turns out to be a 3% annual increase if you average it out, and the savings are really quite cost effective. So we're just hoping that we can get some support from you to continue that and spread it a little bit throughout the state.
I see that that mediators get 30 hours of training. Who has oversight over the over the mediators, and is there a complaint process or repeal process for those individuals who felt the cases weren't handled properly?
Minnesota Supreme Court Administration has, we have guidelines we operate under, and that's who we submit our reports to right now. And not only is there 30 hours of training required, but there's also 6 hours of continuing education a year, and those reports all get filed by our programs through the state. And one of our members actually is on the ADR, Alternative Dispute Resolution Review Board. So, yes, there is a committee that reviews complaints. And I don't know if you have time, but we did have a police officer and a volunteer mediator that we're hoping to say a word or two.
We're sort of running out of time, if they can keep it very brief.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, as they come up, I just like to note for the committee, we have a special guest in the audience, a former member of this committee, now a member of the bench, the Honorable Doug Meslow is in the back of the room there, and I'd like the committee to welcome former representative, now Judge Meslow, back to the legislature.
Thank you, Representative Coles. Welcome, Judge. Okay, quickly, we have a couple minutes and then we're going to move to the next bill. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Pauline Luna. I am a police officer with the City of St. Paul, and I'm actually the West District Commander. I also sit as the board chair for the Dispute Resolution Center. I'm just here to let you know about the community benefits that mediation brings. Personally, we use community mediation routinely as a source to resources for noise complaints, vandalism, landlord tenants, and right now language barriers. In the City of St. Paul, it's a huge issue right now. And they form a basis to allow for peaceful resolutions in our communities. When our communities are peaceful, they are solid, they are strong, they then prevent further crimes. So it's efficient, it's effective, it's affordable. And it empowers our community. It empowers our victims of crime because they now have a say in what happens. They have a say in how to turn this around. It also holds the suspects accountable. It not then lets them hear what they did and the impact that it has, and it allows for a plan to resolve these conflicts so that we don't have these continual calls for service. Calls for service and the repeat calls for service for the police department are a huge cost in our budgets. This allows us to deter those police activities, allowing us to do other police services at a cost effectiveness to the mediation. It allows for one less 911 call, because this is true crime to all of these victims. But in the scheme of crime, it's not as high for our police services. It provides the forum for the healing communities, and it empowers the individuals to be part of their community and to seek solutions for future disputes also, and they now have the tools. So it allows us that in that toolbox, and I just want you to know how important it is to us as police officers to have that tool and that resource to help our communities become stronger.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Calder Hibbert. I'm a volunteer mediator with the Minneapolis Mediation Program, and I'll try and keep my comments brief here to move along. As mentioned before, we have gone through the 30-hour training. I do a minimum of 8 hours of continuing education every year, and these mediators, I've worked with ones from attorneys to auto mechanics, everyone in between, so mediators come from a diverse background. Just to give you a little idea of what the process is, just a minute or two. Mediators, we serve as neutrals. We don't decide who's right or wrong. We ask questions to help folks clarify the situation and try to bring the dispute to a resolution. We allow parties to say their piece, and through my experience, I've found that that's often more important than actually how maybe the resources get divided up in the end. It's that people were heard is the important part. We help them build options and then put together some kind of plan in order to resolve their dispute. In contrast to the legal process, I think this mediation is really important. It incorporates ownership in the solution. There have been a number of studies showing that people are more compliant with mediated agreements than there are with judgments, because those people had a say in what the outcome was instead of having that kind of put upon them. It's not an all or nothing situation. It also reduces costs in resolving disputes, which is especially important for low-income folks, but anybody who's tracking the bottom line, that can be important for as well. Most importantly, in my opinion, I think it helps folks deal with future conflicts. They learn some skills so we don't have these problems, kind of as was mentioned here before. It allows for this discussion and understanding between parties so they don't have to get into a courtroom. And I've had folks that have come in so mad that, you know, they won't look at each other or they have something to read and the paper's shaking or something like that. And when they walk out of there, they're patting each other on the back. It's people that have lived, you know, been mad at each other for 20 years, lived next door to each other, something like that. Numerous police calls. And they walk out of there patting each other on the back and saying, why don't you call me sometime? So I really encourage you to support this bill going forward. I think it's really important. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hibbert, for your testimony. Representative Hillstrom, we now have a quorum. So Representative Hillstrom is moving House File 1904. And now Representative Hillstrom is offering the 073104 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I think it's the A1
amendment. Oh, the A1 amendment to House File 1904. On page 2, line 11, I assume that we're putting a period after the word budget?
Correct.
And then deleting in the rest of the line?
That's correct.
That's correct. Okay. Is there any discussion on the A1 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Now we have the bill in front of us. Is there any discussion or questions of the author? Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I have two questions, and I can't direct them to the author. Representative Hillstrom, on the bill, on page 2, line 2, I see we are striking the phrase other than the state and inserting other sources, which would then envision programs that are totally state-funded. Is there not a danger in doing that if a program becomes totally dependent upon state revenue and we have another downturn, God forbid, in the state economy, that we've now created a collapse of a program rather than having a mechanism where a program doesn't become totally dependent upon the state?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Biskins, I can't tell you why they chose to put it that way. I have no issues with leaving, you know, the state, that sentence in there. It's just many of these programs do get other sources of funding. They get federal grants. They get grants from the local community. And we just thought other sources would be an easy fix.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, but leaving the phrase as it is would still allow for other grants, federal grants, et cetera, and really telling those programs that they should go out and secure those also just in case there is a downturn in the state. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, if I heard you correctly, then would you find it a friendly amendment to on line 2.2 to strike the new language and reinstate the stricken language?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. They informed me that part of this came because the court systems that used to be by the county are now all taken over by the state. And so if they got money through the court system previously, that now is state money.
Ms. Bailey-Allen, do you have anything you want to add to this?
I think in an attempt to be financially solvent, these organizations are linking services to contracts for services. And one of the large contracts recently went from being a county line item to being a statewide line item with the whole statewide coverage of our court system. We also are in a position where we can receive contracts with schools, and that ends up being a statewide line item, even though it may be local schools districts that we are working with. So it allows the organizations to more closely link the services to the funding through contracts for services.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I don't think I made a formal amendment, so I don't have one to withdraw at this point, but I do have one other question.
Go ahead.
Representative Hillstrom, Ms. Quint talked quite a bit about the desire for other programs to start up, and that is one of the reasons for the increased funding, and one that seems admirable. However, Representative Hillstrom, in your amendment, when you struck the remainder of the sentence on line 211, you basically created a situation where one program, potentially the St. Paul program, could eat up the entire pot of funding. I think one of the reasons for the not more than caveat was simply to encourage the creation of programs throughout the state. However, when those words are struck, now it is very possible for one program to eat up the entire pot of money. So I'm wondering why you would have done that.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Biskin. It was very difficult to argue for that increase by itself to 50,000. And so this was just an attempt to say that if it's no, it can't be more than half of the estimated annual budget, rather than increasing the amount by doubling the threshold that a program could qualify for. Does that make sense?
It would make sense probably if I could see that all of the programs have an annual budget of $100,000 or less. However, a program that has an annual budget of $500,000, $750,000, $1 million could very easily now, because of the change in language, eat up the entire pot.
Yes, you could.
Representative Hillstrom. Ms. Bailey Allen.
One of the things that we've learned in the 20 years since that language came about for the is that that second cap, we have a percentage cap and then we have a dollar amount cap. It outdates the language very quickly, and it has prevented some cost-effective strategies for community mediation centers. For example, it discourages mergers when mergers might otherwise make financial sense. It has discouraged the growth from one organization to serve more communities, and it takes away the potential for one established community to serve as an incubator for a new rural community until they can get on their feet. Some of the models that we are looking at is how can some of these established community organizations, by forming a satellite or by acting as an incubator for 3 to 5 years, help some of these areas that do not have access to mediation services provide that. And right there, right now, there's no incentive to do that because there would be no more money available in order to take on another region.
Okay, members, I don't see any other questions. The chair will lay over House File 1904 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus public safety finance bill. Thank you for your testimony, all of those who came. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Next, we will take House File 21. President Amsels, how long was your bill? Do you have testifiers on your bill?
Very short.
Okay, why don't you come up and do your bill? House File 1979. Representative Amsel, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Joining me at the witness table for very brief comments are two county probation employees, Steve Pequé from Chisago County and Tom Peltier from my home county of Itasca. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, as a former county commissioner, I have to say that the partnership between state government and county government involving public safety and county probation is very, very important. But I must say that what House File 1979 is attempting to correct is deterioration of that partnership. and the partnership is deteriorating on a financial level. In Minnesota, you know that there are 87 counties, 32 of whom provide probation services through Community Corrections Act block grants. My bill deals with the 55 other counties who are not part of the block grant. The way the system is supposed to work is that the funding for county probation is supposed to be on a 50% basis, a shared responsibility between state government and these 55 counties. Due to budgetary problems, constraints over the past many years, that 50-50 balance is no longer there. And the governor's budget recommendation in the Department of Corrections budget further exacerbates this problem by not appropriating, not recommending enough money to the legislature to get us to the 50-50 split. We are significantly below 50-50, and this bill intends to appropriate the money to get us to 50-50. And with that, I'll turn it over to our testifiers for very brief comment.
Good morning. My name is Steve Picoy, County Court Service Officer for Chisago County. I'm also the legislative chair for the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers, MACPO. Thanks for allowing us to speak today on in support of House File 1979. This bill is going to have some impact on the property tax relief for local counties as well as public safety for the residents of those counties. Minnesota has historically been a state in which relies heavily on probation as a sentencing option. We're constantly in the top tier of states using probation. According to 19 data from 2004, Minnesota is 74% higher than the average national average number of probationers per 100,000 people. We're the fourth highest. At the same time, we're 57% lower than the national average of incarcerated adults per 100,000. That's the 49th highest. So you can see that Minnesota places a huge number of people on probation. In addition to the numbers, over the past few years, probation officers have been given many new responsibilities, such as performing mental health and CD screens, taking UAs, DNA samples, working in truancy programs and drug courts. The result is that probation officers are frequently stretched too thinly. Minnesota has three systems of providing probation services: the Community Corrections Act County, CPO reimbursement, which is what we'll be talking about, and DOC contract counties, which are included in this bill. Minnesota has three funding streams for probation services. The first is the CCA Act, which we alluded to. That's an act which appropriates state funding to 32 counties for all their correction services. Then the county probation officer reimbursement, which is what we're addressing in House File 1979. That's 55 counties are funded under this system, 28 county probation officer counties, and 27 DOC contract counties. Under this system, the state pays up to 50% of the salary and fringe for approved probation officer positions. County pays for all the other costs, including office space, mileage, supplies, etc. The last time the reimbursement was at the 50% level was 1996. In 2000, the reimbursement was 41%, and that's due a large part from lobbying from my organization and other corrections ones. Without an additional appropriation, we would have been down to 38.7%. The individual counties make up the resulting funding difference from their local property taxes, and that's where the property tax issue is. In the past 4 years, Chisago County has absorbed a deficit of $129,000. Probation caseload reduction grants is another funding stream. This is a statewide program which provides additional probation officer funds to the above two funding programs. It was started in 1996 following the release of the 1994 Probation Standards Report. The goal was to reduce existing probation caseloads by increasing funding for additional probation officers. The report found that Minnesota needed 562 new probation officers to meet the supervision standards for the 1993 probation cases. At the end of 2000, only 256 new probation officers were hired. The statewide caseloads continue to increase. We simply fall further behind, and we may well be worse off than we were in 1993. The funding for these three funding streams was reduced in 2003 by 8% and then frozen, and there's no new money in the governor's budget for the probation caseload reduction. In addition to some of the cuts, we've also run into difficulty with state and federal grants drying up. Chisago County operated a juvenile accountability block grant for a number of years, which helped pay for a case aide and a juvenile community service work crew. When that grant dried up, Chisago County absorbed the cost. Likewise, in 2003, the ISP grants for repeat drunk drivers was ended, and the number of counties absorbed those costs as well. What's happening is that many counties have tried to deal with reduced funding and increasing number of probation cases by increasing the size of the caseloads or assigning the cases. What's happening at the same time is we're becoming more aware of what's known as evidence-based practices. Studies have shown that by using some of these practices, which are risk needs assessments, supervision by risk level, offender-specific planning, recidivism can be reduced. The frustration is that while Minnesota corrections professionals have developed probation toolbox of proven techniques, we don't have enough workers to use the tools correctly. Unless this bill is passed, county boards who are already absorbing the costs of insufficient reimbursement are going to be less likely to hire the new probation officers to help us out. I have with us resolutions from 25 counties, all strongly supporting that the 2007 legislature appropriates sufficient funds to reimburse the 55 participating counties for the full 50% reimbursement. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Sir, you want to introduce yourself for the record, and if your comments could be real brief.
I could do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Peltier. I'm director of Itasca County Court Services and also a probation officer in that county. I'd like to make two points. I think Mr. Pequay covered everything. The two points that I'd like to bring home are that the reality for small departments like ours is that the uncertain amount of 50% funding since 1966 has created a reluctance on our county board to hire additional probation officers. For example, in our department in Itasca County, we have over 600 adult gross misdemeanor and misdemeanor clients. These are, for the most part, DWI and domestic assault cases. Up until last year, we only had two agents handling those 600 cases. We now have a third agent, which the board has appropriated for us, on the understanding that we would get 50% reimbursement from the state. It just creates that reluctance every time we do that. We need to go back for additional adult agents. 200 cases of adult supervision is too much for an agent. We need to add an additional case. The board will be reluctant if we don't get that 50% reimbursement. And the other area would be in our budgeting process each year. Over the past 3 years, the Itasca County Board has cut each department approximately 3% in funding. But when we come to the end of the year, they base that on the 50% reimbursement. The fact that we only got 38% and then 40% respectfully from the state meant that we were lower. We couldn't meet the needs. We couldn't meet the budget, and then the county was reluctant to give us a new position. So that's what I wanted to bring home, is that in order to get a new position and to get intensive supervision agents that we'd like to in the future, we need to get that 50% reimbursement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peltier. Any questions? Representative Anzalez, you have a blank appropriation there. You have a sense of what this...
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for asking. The Department of Corrections has not completed the fiscal note. The numbers are, the governor's rec is $600,000 and $600,000, and we estimate to make this program whole and to renew the partnership, we need to be at 1.8 and 1.8. That's our estimate.
Okay. Any closing remarks, Representative Enzo? We're going to move on.
I just appreciate the committee's support.
Okay. The chair will move House File 1979, and the chair will lay over House File 1979 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Mr. Piquet, was it? And Mr. Peltier, thank you for your testimony. Representative Enzo,
thank you
for
presenting
the bill. And the final bill on our calendar for today is House File 2139. I'm sorry, Representative Simon. And now here he comes. And members, I've noticed that there's a significant amount of people that want to testify on this bill, and we are going to adjourn at 10 o'clock, so we'll have to put some kind of a time limit on testimony. Representative Simon, maybe if we said that we had 15 minutes for proponents of the bill and then 15 minutes for opponents, that gives us ample time for discussion. Do you think your testifiers can fit within that time frame? We can be a little flexible, but...
Okay.
So, Representative Simon, welcome to the committee. Representative Bigham is moving House File 2134. The intent of the chair to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Go ahead, Representative Simon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity. House File 2134 is an opportunity to correct injustice. And there are really two kinds of injustices here. The first one is the injustice that happens any time a child is sexually abused. We all know that. But the other injustice here is the disregard shown by the Supreme Court in the state of Minnesota for what this legislature did in 1989. And to that extent, all this bill does is restore us to what we had from 1989 to 1996. I'm proud to say that in 1989, this legislature got serious about sexual abuse. This legislature got it. And in keeping with the prevailing consensus at the time in the medical and psychological communities, this state did what other states did in 1989. And what they said is, look, there's a difference between the abuse and the injury suffered from the abuse. They are not coextensive, and they don't happen at the same time. That is a medical fact. That is a fact of life. That's what the victims tell you, and that's what the doctors tell you. And so we know, as the legislature knew then, that sex abuse is a crime of secrecy, and the victims do not often have the courage to speak out until many, many years later. A child might lack the verbal or emotional skills to come forward, especially when the perpetrator is a family member or another trusted person who uses powerful forms of manipulation. But more important is this reality. Oftentimes, it's only later in life that a person will connect the anguish of the present with the crimes and abuses of the past. And I've seen it, members. I've had victims in my office, tears in their eyes, in their 40s and 50s, who have suffered from and are suffering currently from the effects of childhood sex abuse from someone they trusted, but who currently have no recourse and no way to seek the truth. Meanwhile, the perpetrator has very often gone on to sexually abuse and molest others because that person couldn't seek the truth. So in 1989, this legislature, both houses, signed into law, enacted a delayed discovery rule. Now, delayed discovery is not a new concept in the law. I have a stack here, and I'm happy to read them off for you, of all the many laws in our statute books that have a delayed discovery rule. This isn't scary. This isn't new. This isn't radical. We have it for common law fraud. We have it for asbestos claims, and the list goes on and on and on. So don't let anyone tell you this is new and frightening and radical. Delayed discovery statute in 1989 simply said what lines 12 to 14 of this current bill already say, it's current law. It says that statute of limitations means that an action must be commenced, quote, within 6 years of the time the plaintiff knew or had reason to know that the injury was caused by the sexual abuse, end quote. Now, that language is pretty clear. It couldn't be more clear. But somehow, the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1996 said, no, the legislature didn't really mean 6 years from the time they discovered the connection between the harm or the event and the injury. No, what the legislature meant is 6 years from the age of majority. So now, basically, past age 24, you're out of luck, according to the Minnesota Supreme Court. Even though those words are still on the books, you can look at them in the bill. We don't change current law. I think those words are clear. I think most people, as a matter of common sense, would, but the Minnesota Supreme Court disagreed. And again, this is no different than the delayed discovery statutes we have in other places in law. So all we're doing here is going back to what the legislature wrote in 1989. It gets us closer to the truth, and the language means what it says.
within 6 years of the time the plaintiff knew or had reason to know that the injury was caused by the sexual abuse. There is a window in the statute until 2010 for those who have been time barred for the last several years because of the courts to bring their claims. And, you know, you're going to hear testimony today from several institutions. And they're alarmed, and I'm alarmed that they're alarmed. Because under Minnesota law, under principles of vicarious liability or even direct liability, if you're an employer, you are only liable for the acts, the bad acts, particularly sexual abuse of your employee, if you knew or should have known. Think about that for a second. If you knew or should have known, you should feel nervous about this law. You should feel real nervous. If you didn't know, or if there's no reason you should have known, then you got nothing to worry about. And I'll have members here draw their own conclusions. You're going to hear a lot today. You're going to hear about insurance rate increases, and that's a time-honored bugaboo that's been brought up in every state where this has been passed, about insurance rates are going to skyrocket, and schools are going to be in trouble, and daycare centers are going to be in trouble. All I can tell you is that hasn't happened, and it's not going to happen. You're also going to hear about repressed memory. You're going to hear people try to confuse and conflate the issue and tell you that this is some sort of, you know, armchair psychology, and this is Oprah, and it's about repressed memory. Members, repressed memory is an entirely different creature. Repressed memory is where you don't remember that something even happened to you, and then years later you suddenly remember. That is scientifically dubious, and that's not what this is. Don't let any of the lobbyists or any of the high-paid folks here tell you that that's what it is. This is about someone who, you're damn right they remember what happened to them. They remember it the day of, and the next day, and every day of their lives, but they don't automatically connect the harm, the alcoholism, the drug abuse, the suicide attempts, to what has happened to them until much later. So it's not repressed memory. You're going to hear from the church, from Father McDonough. He's an honorable man, and I've supported him and will continue to in some of his charitable efforts. I think he does a lot of good. I am disappointed, since he's the Senate chaplain, that he's leveraging his position, an official position with the Senate, to lobby on behalf or against bills. And I don't think we tolerate that from Lonnie Titus in the past, nor would we tolerate it from Paul Rogers in the present. That's something the Senate is going to have to take up, but I think it's disappointing. Father McDonough did visit me, as did many of the advocates against this. Sight unseen, I might tell you.
Mr. Chairman,
Hold on, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mullery,
Mr. Chairman, there is, I'm not going to ask a question, but when people are attacking the character of another member of the legislature or staff, I think it's inappropriate.
Mr. I didn't hear that as an attack, but your concern has been noted. Please continue, Representative Stein.
Father McDonough and many of the opponents met with me, and what's important for members to know is they met with me sight unseen. I haven't even introduced the bill yet, and there have been various versions of this bill over the years, and that's telling to me. It says to me that no matter what version I would have introduced, it doesn't matter, they still would have been vehemently against this bill. So before I even dropped the bill in the hopper, when they knew that I was thinking about doing this, they met with me, and there's one thing that Father McDonough said to me, and he's a very decent and honorable man. It's far from an attack. I think he does excellent works in the community, and I'll continue to be his big supporter of those works in the community. But he said something to me that stuck in my mind that I think was unfortunate but telling. He said to me, you know, the problem with litigation is, you know, these people, if we can't move on, they just get stuck in the rage. Stuck in the rage. And I couldn't help think of the guy who had just come to my office and told me how he had genitalia stuck in his face and in his mouth against his will. And yeah, that guy might be stuck in a rage. But to dismiss people who want justice as being stuck in a rage, breathtaking. I can understand why some of the institutions want to move on, get beyond all this, start healing, or what they call healing. But the victims are not ready to move on. They want the truth, and you can give it to them simply by restoring what we already have done in 1989. Go back to what we had, and you can restore that language and with it restore justice for these victims. I'd like to turn it over now to someone who was around in 1989 and who can say what the legislature meant at the time.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Rice-Scott-Young, a former senator. Were you a representative, too, or no. Well, just always a senator? Well, welcome to the committee.
Well, I'm honored to be back. Thank you very much. My name is Ember Rice-Scott-Young, Mr. Chairman and members. I did serve in the Minnesota Senate from 1983 to the year 2000, and I'm the past chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I'm here because, as Representative Simon said, I was the author of some of these amendments back in 1989 and 1991. And so I was there at the table when this passed. And I want to just reiterate several points that he said. Number one, this is not a major change in the law. It is a clarification of what we did back in those years. It is a reaffirmation of what this legislature decided was important to do on behalf of victims of child sexual abuse back in those years of 1989 and 1991. And at that time, in the legislature, we had at this table significant testimony from psychologists and other health providers saying about talking about the emerging science at that point of how these victims of child sexual abuse were taking years and years and years to come forward, that it was impossible for them to come forward immediately, that they had to understand the symptoms that they were feeling, like chemical dependency symptoms or suicidal tendencies. They needed to understand that they were connected to the abuse that had happened to them often 10 to 20 years prior. And so that was the testimony we received. There was not a lot of significant opposition at that time. In fact, I do not remember any significant opposition at that time. This bill passed into law in a bipartisan fashion. In 1991, a window was then amended to the bill. That is the part that I authored. That is similar to the window being proposed now. It would allow victims to come forward who had been barred by the previous statute of limitations. Again, it passed. Again, it was not, it was a little bit controversial, but not, the key concern was that they were afraid a lot of cases would come forward. There would be a lot of victims who would come forward. And let me just tell you that we know now, many years later, that when the window was passed, that not that many cases came forward. A very manageable number came forward. And so I think that gives you comfort that you can pass a window again and not many cases will come forward. It's not going to be an avalanche. But those that are legitimate and do deserve justice will come forward. And then, as Representative Simon mentioned, in 1996 was the key Supreme Court decision called Bacoli Act. And the court really rewrote our legislative intent. And as the author of the bill, I was absolutely appalled at what the court did. And it was ludicrous because in the decision, the court actually wrote, as a matter of law, one is injured if one is sexually abused. You have no idea. In that case, there was an 11-year-old boy who was sexually abused, and they were basically saying that that 11-year-old boy knew that he had been injured because he knew something bad had happened to him. Well, clearly that's ludicrous. You can't obviously know that you're going to have sexual intimacy problems 20 years later when you're 11 years old. You just can't. It doesn't psychologically compute. So in 97 to 2000, we tried to reaffirm the intent of the law. And I was not able to do that as a chief author of this bill. And the key reason that the legislature at that point could not reclarify the law is because there was one difference that emerged between 1997 and 1991, and that was the emergence of a very powerful opponent. The bottom line, the Supreme Court was misguided. The court rewrote a statute that was clear on its face. All this legislation does is reaffirm what the legislature did back in the 90s. We'll just fast forward to today. To me, the real issue today is not just about justice for victims, and that is clearly a very important piece of this. But to me, and what has maintained my interest in this legislation for years, is that this bill, to me, is the single most important tool that you can pass to prevent child sexual abuse today. It is the key tool available. The Minnesota County Attorneys Association supports this legislation because of that. Why? Because very, very few of these cases are ever reported to the criminal justice authorities. The only way many of these perpetrators are ever identified is by identifying them in the civil lawsuit. And we know that perpetrators can have up to 100 victims. Maybe one victim might come forward, but that means that many, many other victims are still being abused. So, the three key points. This reaffirms what the legislature did. The window does not provide for an avalanche of cases. Indeed, only legitimate cases have come forward in the past. Secondly, it is the most important tool to prevent child abuse.
Thank you, Ms. Rescott-Young, for your testimony. Who's next? Please state your name for the record, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Dimmitt. I am a survivor.
Hold on, you've done it. 1 second. Did you have a question of the testifier?
Well, no, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a question of you. I mean, the discussion is
absolutely good, and we ought to have it as a legislature, but I'm a little confused about why we're having the discussion here and not in Chair Mullery's committee. I haven't heard a word yet about the appropriation. In fact, Ms. Reichstadt-Young just talked about the importance of identifying these individuals through the civil process. And I guess I'm curious if we're talking about the fiscal part of this, or if we're talking about the policy part, and if the bill's going to go to Representative Mullery's committee, because I think it certainly needs to. I'm not quite sure why it didn't start there. It seems kind of backwards.
Representative Coles, I'm sure that Representative Simon will discuss the appropriation. I wanted him to introduce the bill. This bill was referred here by the Finance Committee. We have the testifiers here. As a courtesy to the author, I think we should hear the bill. If you want to make a motion at some point to refer the bill, that's to Representative Mullery's committee. That's certainly within your ability as a member of this body. If you want to, we can do whatever we want. I think we should just hear the testifiers and then we can decide. It would be the most respectful thing to do at this point. Okay. Go ahead, sir. I'm sorry. Introduce yourself for the record again. And we really don't have a lot of time now for the proponents of the bill because we want to give the opponents ample opportunity, so you have to cut your testimony a little short.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is Paul Dimmitt, and I will be as brief as I can. I've been silenced for over 15 years, so I understand the time constraints. I have had an opportunity to meet with some of these committee members in private in their office back in 2003. My journey really started in 2002 with a piece of paper about this big on the seat of my truck while I was traveling at 120 miles an hour ready to take my life. My life was in shambles. I had lots of issues that I was trying to work out. I couldn't figure out why it was happening to me, but I knew it was bad enough that I didn't want to live anymore. My wife saved my life that day by just allowing me to pick her up from work. Then I was admitted into the hospital for 2 weeks under suicide intervention. And it was at that point when my suicide note was my beacon of hope. It was at that point in which it was brought to my attention that I was groomed. And that's one thing that we haven't talked about yet today, but what is grooming? And grooming is when something happens to you and you don't realize that it is happening. It is when you think that you are making choices and decisions along the way, and then at one point there's a crossover of trust, a broken trust. A relationship goes to a level in which you never thought it was going to be before. And there's no going back. The shame that starts infiltrating your whole body. And it wasn't until I was in the hospital at age 30 before I realized that all the issues that I was dealing with in my life may be attributed to the fact that I was sexually abused by a school teacher. As soon as I realized, it took me 2 weeks to call law enforcement, to make a complaint, for them to investigate, for the county attorneys to prosecute and put this person in prison where he still is today. Thank God. But the real issue is, during that time, I also learned that this institution, this school district, had reason to believe, in my opinion, that he was a danger and a risk. And I couldn't, in good conscience, when my abuser admitted to abusing up to 100 other kids, I couldn't not pursue civil litigation against them. And it went to the state Supreme Court, and they denied to hear my story, to hear my claim, for the same reasons that our other people have spoken today. I'm here today because I don't want what I went through to happen to children anymore when they do, if they do, gain the strength and the courage to come forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your courage to come down here and testify before the committee. Who's next?
We're running out of time. Quickly, and I would even make a bargain with you for every minute we get go over, you can give two to the other side. Just one other person to be heard by the members. Thank you.
Sir, please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Paymar and committee members. My name is Mark Malinger. It's been 30 years now since I was sexually abused by the priest who was a trusted family friend and vocation director from Crozier Seminary High School in Onania, Minnesota. For many, including myself, it's hard to understand why it took so many years for me to confront this event and its ramifications. The reality is, while I knew the abuse occurred, I was led by guilt and shame to hide the abuse from others and, as best I could, from myself. But over the past few years, my wife and daughter have observed and heard the screaming and crying that occur while I relive the abuse in my dreams. They see the fading look in my eyes as I detach from the present moment because something has triggered the abuse. They have witnessed me having epileptic seizures caused by the stress of these memories. 2 years ago, I was hospitalized and diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder caused by the sexual abuse and began taking antidepressant medications. I'm now in psychotherapy working through the emotional, psychological, and physical ramifications of the abuse. And I'm learning techniques to help live with the post-traumatic stress disorder, which I've now realized will be there for the rest of my life. It's the most painful thing I can imagine dealing with, and my family as well. One of the most painful aspects of this is the lack of responsibility and accountability the Crozier religious order and my abuser, who is still a priest, have accepted. There is no disputing the abuse occurred, and there is no denying the tremendous cost, emotional, financial, and physical, my family and I have paid for this abuse. Yet, after several letters to the Crozers, from myself, two psychiatrists, and a therapist, requesting financial assistance with my health care costs related to the abuse, there has been no acknowledgement of the abuse, no apology, and no offering of financial support. And this is not a rare occurrence, as I found out. There are many people who were sexually abused as children who live with tremendous guilt and shame, and I'm meeting many of them now as I come forward. And they feel there is no hope for healing and for justice to occur. As a part of my recovery, I hope to prevent other children from having to go through a similar experience by confronting and exposing my abuser in a court of law. But this can be a problem, as we've heard, with all the legislative changes that have occurred with the Senate. I'm very, very grateful to Senator Simon and to others who have brought this bill forward. This legislation would help to expose and further prevent victimization of children. And for this reason, I urge Minnesota legislators and this committee to take up this cause and not let the irresponsible institution and their powerful lobbyists, for whatever reason, delay justice any longer. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony and for your courage for coming down here. Representative Simon, could you briefly explain Section 2 of the bill?
Sure. In talking with some of the advocates, one of the issues that's come up over the years is reporting, particularly by juveniles, either when they're juveniles or after they're juveniles, but reporting of juvenile sex abuse. There's a lot more research that needs to be done, and I'm not pretending that this one study could solve it all. But this is a group in Winona that works with prosecutors all over the country. They have an outstanding reputation, and they are willing to undertake this study and very eager to do so.
Very good. Now we'll hear from the opponent. I'm not sure who wants to speak first. We have about 15 minutes. I'd like to give committee members an opportunity to ask questions of Representative Simon and discuss the matter. And if we have more time after that, I'm happy to allow other members of the audience to speak who wish to speak on the bill.
Good morning.
Good morning. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Phyllis Willichai, and I'm the former Victim Assistance Coordinator, Director of Advocacy for the Archdiocese of St. Paul, Minneapolis. The former because I retired a year ago.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
I served in that capacity for over 15 years under Archbishop Roach and then Harry Flynn. During that time, I met with many people. I met with some of the people that you've heard this morning, who had experienced clergy sexual misconduct from different faiths, from not only the Catholic Church, but from many other faiths. But my primary position was to help people here in this archdiocese who lived here, whether they were abused here or other parts of the country. My role was to listen to their stories in an effort to find the resources that they needed to begin and work through the healing process. Victims are being served in this archdiocese and have been for a very long time. It didn't matter when or where the abuse happened, whether it was abused in Florida or Minnesota, Arizona, wherever. We still helped them make connections they needed, and I listened with the ear of the heart to hear many of these same stories, some of them very, very tragic, and if you can feel the tugs on your heart when you listen today. I helped them to find their voices when they were ready. We seek to empower them and give them a public voice in addition to providing them with professional services, whether it's helping them with names of therapists who understand the issues of sexual misconduct, whether it be a spiritual director, retreats, or whatever they need at the time. I always ask the victim the question, what do you need to heal at this time? I receive many different requests, as every case is a unique person, and they have many different steps they need to go through. It could take one meeting with them face-to-face, it could take 50, and all the time you're listening to them to find out what they need to go forward. It would be to go with them and visit a bishop in another diocese in another state so they can tell their story. They could be recovering personal items from the offender. Some much needed cash for assistance with therapy, support groups, spiritual direction, anything that would help them to move on with their healing process. That support group, I worked as a co-facilitator of an ecumenical support group for women that met on Monday evenings consisting of 12 sessions for over 10 years. The important point about the support group is that it started because a victim asked me to start a support group. That was one of the needs that she felt was important, and it's still going on. We did this with an Episcopal priest and a therapist and myself, setting up the process and how that would be done to help them, help her and others to begin to heal. As I said, it's still going on today with new members going in and others moving on. The importance of therapy and support groups helps people to begin to heal. Healing does not happen when a person is defined by their rage. They have to work through that process, and that's what I help them to do, to find what got to the basis of it. Healing happens as people begin to name what happened to them, to choose an action goal to work with, and they can gradually proceed. Healing happens in this archdiocese because we have been there, listened with respect and dignity, empowering them to move on, even to the point of their being with them, being able to confront their offender, you go with them and help them confront them, which gives them back the power that was taken away from them. My experience is that we've seen many victims move through to survivorhood and even strong independence. They would move out of the support group and go on to empower themselves in their efforts. In my experience, for most victims, this is not about money or lawsuits. they told me what they needed the most was to be heard and believed. And we listened to them for as long as it takes to help them. They mainly wanted to make sure the offender was not able to continue to harm other victims. And also the legal system can be a very painful process and can actually re-victimize the victim. That choice would always be given to them if they chose to do that. But it was an option. I provided many options for them. Therefore, as I stated earlier, victims are being served because we have been doing it for many, many years, albeit quietly at the request of the victim. Many victims don't want to get it put in the newspaper so that their families and everybody can see this. They want it to just work through their healing process. So at the request of the victim, we would not make it public. Nonetheless, many have moved on, hopefully, to achieve their full potential in this world. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Sir, please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Father Kevin McDonough from the Archdiocese of St. Paul, Minneapolis, where I'm the Chief of Staff and the pastor of St. Peter Claver, a small African-American parish near the state capital. If I may address two preliminary notes briefly. I have the privilege of serving as the chaplain of the Senate, as Representative Simon accurately pointed out, and I respectfully submit that I did talk with Senator Pogemiller before accepting the position in order to let him know that I'm often an informational source on this matter, and told him that I expected that would have to happen this legislative session. Then when it was clear that bills would be introduced, I cycled back to him again and asked him for the ground rules of whatever engagement I would have. So please know that I want to be tremendously respectful for your process and not misrepresent my work in any way in that regard. I also want to add my gratitude to Representative Simon for his past support, and I appreciated his pledge of continued charitable support today. Thank you, Representative. That was very generous of you. Thank you. I'm not competent to speak to the relationship between the legislature and the Supreme Court. You have to make your choices about that. I want you to know that the Minnesota churches and religious institutions, because it also includes mosques, I've assisted with a Buddhist Zen school, and our synagogues have taken seriously the legislature since the mid-1980s. And in fact, in the mid to late 1980s, we worked with citizen committees and with the legislature to extend protections in a variety of ways to the vulnerable, the very vulnerable people we often serve. I want you to know that in Minnesota, as distinct from many places, unfortunately, in the country, the religious community here developed programming that's been a national model in our various denominations. And I obviously, every person who reads a newspaper or watches TV knows the terrible, terrible history of my own church around the nation. I wish that other churches in other states had learned from the Minnesota leadership, and a great deal of that credit goes to the Minnesota legislature, but I want you to know that the church has voluntarily cooperated and worked even in the development of laws as late as the mid-1980s. Particularly important, I think, it's to note that since the early 1990s, extraordinary efforts at safety education have taken place. We're currently training over 200,000 children in Roman Catholic institutions around the state of Minnesota. ELCA Lutherans and other churches are doing exactly the same thing. Please note that, by the way, these are not state-mandated programs, and in fact, Minnesota, unlike many states, does not mandate the extensive safety training that might benefit our kids. And with respect for Senator Reichgott Young, I'd like to say that perhaps if you wished to promote early reporting and an aggressive stance toward children's safety, we might begin in terms of developing and perhaps funding, and I know that's a hard word for you all, but more aggressive training for our young people. We're doing it in the Catholic Church and in the Lutheran churches, and we're doing it with the gifts that our people give to us. There's a fiscal note to all of this. Of course, we would like to be able to continue our prevention work. We think that's the best thing we can do for the future. Very difficult to do when we're having to spend our funds to defend 40 and 50-year-old claims, and that's our concern. Please know that your Minnesota religious institutions cooperate with all the criminal reporting statutes. I have called the police on priests. I continue to do so. I've called the police on staff members of churches. We'll continue to do so. And we require our employees much more broadly than does Minnesota criminal statutory language. We require our people to consider themselves reporters. Thank you all.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify against the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dozlin, and I represent the Minnesota Child Care Association. MCCA is an association representing licensed child care centers throughout the state of Minnesota. Licensed child care centers place the highest priority on ensuring their children's safety and must meet numerous state laws in order to be licensed. Current requirements include mandatory background studies on staff, minimum student-staff ratios requirements, mandatory emergency and accident plans, mandatory unannounced inspections and investigations of complaints, and mandated reporting under the Maltreatment of Minors Act. Other voluntary safety precautions implemented by licensed centers include additional staff training on child safety measures, security systems and cameras in classrooms, and policies and procedures on who has access to the building and classrooms. MCCA has concerns about efforts to lengthen the statute of limitations. Over time, records may not be kept, the company or center may no longer exist, and individuals and roles of authority have died or their whereabouts unknown. As a result, it becomes more difficult to establish the facts and to prove allegations. Without these, it becomes nearly impossible for a licensed child care center to adequately defend itself. Thank you for your time, and I'll be available for questions.
Hi, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Grace Schwab, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. The Minnesota School Boards Association is a private, nonprofit organization that provides technical assistance, cost-saving programs, advocacy, training, research, and referral services for all of Minnesota's public schools. Membership is voluntary. All of Minnesota public school districts, including many charter schools, have been elected to become our members. Public elementary and secondary education in Minnesota is provided by, in the state, by 343 local school districts and 140 charter schools. In 05 and 06, the full-time equivalent teaching staff in Minnesota is 52,213, with approximately 825,000 students. Presently, school districts are funded with about 70% state funding, 24% local funding, and 6% funding from the federal government. School districts are particularly vulnerable to these types of civil lawsuits under House File 2134. Schools are not nonprofit institutions. Awards have to come from local school budgets, which would likely draw resources away from the classroom. Recent awards in federal court in Michigan and New Mexico have granted victims $2.1 and $3.2 million, respectively. This simply means today's children we have to pay yesterday's abusers. Today's school districts have multiple policies on dealing with sexual abuse and harassment. It is also incumbent upon staff to report any abuse they suspect might be affecting a child at the present time and looking back 3 years. If House File 2134 was enacted, how could school districts defend themselves from dated claims? Would staff be available? Could records be found? Was insurance available? Did past insurance coverage match today's awards? In the end, members, school districts need state guidance, assistance, and thoughtfulness on this issue. Today's students deserve the best education that the state can provide. Should the bad actions of past abusers have the right to again victimize and hurt today's students? Thank you, Mr.
Thank you for your testimony. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Karen Bockelman. I'm a pastor of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. I serve presently as assistant to the Bishop of the Northeastern Minnesota Synod, where one of my areas of responsibility is to assist the bishop in investigations and in providing services in cases of clergy sexual misconduct. I am also the present chair of the Minnesota Religious Council. I primarily want to second the things that Father McDonough said about the work that is going on and has been going on for many years in the religious community in Minnesota, especially through the Minnesota Council of Churches and the church bodies that are part of the Minnesota Religious Council. I want to highlight a couple of things that Father Dunnah did not mention. First of all, our church bodies have written policies and written disciplinary procedures and written statement or suggestion, not suggestions, written requirements of behavior of our clergy, all of which prohibit clergy sexual misconduct and abuse of children, vulnerable adults, and adults, and which provide a process by which, through church discipline, such persons can be disciplined. We have zero tolerance for this kind of behavior, which means in the ELCA, all allegations are investigated. We listen to all victims. Proven misconduct has consequences for the perpetrator, and information is shared. We do public disclosure. When misconduct has been proven, we disclose not only to the clergy person's present congregation, but to past congregations, and we have a process by which that information would be shared more widely so that someone can't go to another congregation and pretend it never happened. We do regular power and boundaries training for clergy and other professionals. We educate clergy, congregations, their members, their children, their lay leaders, and judicatory officials in this matter. We do, as Father McDonough said, comply with Minnesota law, with the statute 148A, and with the mandatory reporting laws. We train, offer, and welcome advocates to walk with victims through this process. We assist victims, primary and secondary victims, with counseling. We train and assist after pastors who would serve in a congregation after there's been a case of misconduct, so that the healing in the congregation has a possibility of happening as well. And we follow up with congregations. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Sir, we've gone way over the amount of time here. I'll give you like 1 minute if you can just make a quick comment. I apologize for that.
I understand. My name is Dan Connolly. I am a lawyer working with the Minnesota Religious Council. And it's important to note that the Minnesota Religious Council is not only involved sometimes in lobbying and explaining legislation, but also in advising the religious bodies that we work with on how to comply with legislative procedure. I'll just speak to one topic since many of the others have already been talked about. The importance here is the integrity of the legal process. Statutes of limitations provide bright lines for when cases can be brought for good reason, and that is to prevent old cases from going to courts when inadequate evidence and insufficient availability of funds and resources and documents are available to defend the cases. California adopted a window for allowing all old cases to be brought. In San Diego County, San Diego Archdiocese, which just declared bankruptcy, half of the cases that were brought involved dead priests. The delayed discovery statutes are found frequently in the statutes, but they all have reasonable person standards. That is, they are cut off. The claims are brought within a time period of when a person knew or should have known that an event occurred. And in that context, the Minnesota Supreme Court was entirely consistent with all of the other cases that are out there in the Blachowiak case. And the last point that I would make, Chairman, as I see you getting ready to cut me off, is that almost every other delayed discovery statute of limitations that there is in the statute book in Minnesota, there is a statute of repose. And we would recommend that if this committee is inclined to proceed with this, that it investigate statutes of repose as many of the lawyers here are familiar with, those are found in, for example, the improvement to real property and other areas of the law.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, we have a few minutes for questions. I know other committee members have to leave at 10. I'd like to take a vote on it one way or the other, or lay the bill over one way or the other. Representative Cole is here first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm concerned about taking a vote on the bill now because if it's going to stick in this committee or be laid over, I have a whole bunch of questions about the cost to the courts in order to help create what I hope would be an appropriate fiscal note. So we fully recognize not only the policy issues that are here, but also the cost to the court system. But Mr. Chair, as I mentioned before, I think that the bill, I believe that Representative Simon is bringing forth a good faith effort to deal with a very real policy issue. And I respect what he is doing. As I look at the bill, Mr. Chair, I see at least four and maybe more policy issues that the Civil Justice Committee, I believe, should look at. The first, I note that throughout the bill, we are changing the term plaintiff to victim. I'm not exactly sure why that's happening. I haven't had a chance, and I don't know that I have time today to ask Representative Simon about that. We also are using in the standard the term fully comprehend the causal connection. And I'm just not quite sure what that means, and I think that really is setting the standard, and that's a policy issue that I believe the Civil Justice Committee ought to have an opportunity to look at. Thirdly, clearly anything related to statute of limitations is something clearly within the jurisdiction of the Civil Justice Committee, as I understand it, and I believe it ought to go there. And fourthly, Mr. Chair, the study that we're creating, it appears to be a new study. I believe it's a new study. I think that's a policy issue as well. I'm not saying that it's not the right way, where, place for the funds to go, or the right type of study to do. In fact, I that's part of the bill I like best, I think. And so I hope that whatever happens, we're able to keep that study alive this year. But, Mr. Chair, because of those policy reasons, I do move that the bill be referred to Representative Mulry's Public Safety and Civil Justice Policy Committee.
Representative Coles has moved that House File 2134 be referred to the Public Safety Policy and Civil Justice Committee.
Representative Mulry's Committee.
Public Safety and Civil Justice.
Representative Simon.
If I may speak to the amendment, Mr. Chair, and I want to be honest with committee members, I have a companion bill, as I'm sure some of you know, that I introduced early in the session. Chair Mulry, for reasons that I respect, I'm not going to change his mind. I understand he refuses to hear the bill, and he's adamant about this. I give him credit. He's consistent. There was once a roll call on the floor a few years ago. It was like 127-4. He was one of the four. He hates this bill, and that's okay. I'm not trying to change his mind. He will not hear it. He will not hear this if it's sent to his committee, unless, Chairman Mulry, you can say on the record today if you'll hear the bill now or ever. Will you hear the bill, Chairman Mulry, this year before deadline?
Will you pull your microphone down, please?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how we would have a really thorough hearing. This, Mr. Chairman and Representative Simon, I don't think this is the kind of bill that we could act responsibly on and rush through like is being done this morning. I think this is a disgrace to the legislature to do this kind of thing, the whole setup. And I think that this is something that does require a lot of study. I think this requires all kinds of study. What are we doing to... Why would we do this to just the statute of limitations on one thing when there's other things that cry out even more for a change, and we are doing it without a study of the effect of this? We're claiming that this is the goal. I thought that we were trying to get at is stopping this abuse from continuing, and yet we're not doing anything in that line. We unfortunately didn't hear anything other than Representative Simon say that this is a good training center. If this was something good, I'd put in, you know, millions of dollars into this if we were going to get somewhere. But all I heard was about 10 seconds saying this is a good training center. We're not even dealing with the real issue why it's here. I talked to a former chair of the policy committee for both civil and criminal law, and he said it's that if Chair Pamar includes the policy from this in his criminal law finance bill, that it makes the whole bill unconstitutional. And so I'm now suddenly worried about what I'm going to do, because I had intended to wrap our criminal law bills into his finance criminal bill. And so now suddenly I don't want to lose all our criminal law bills from the year just because a Chair Paymer may be wrapping this into his finance bill. This is a real sudden thing that was done without any consultation, and I don't know what's going to happen now. I would like to hear the whole issue thoroughly, the whole issue of what we can do at getting at stopping this abuse of minors sexually. I think it's something that this legislature has to do. I think that the issue of statutes and limitation is something that if we're going to do it in one situation, we should be doing it across the board. We don't take one because they put in some money or something and do it. I don't think that's the way that the legislature should operate. And would I like to look at this issue, both those issues of statutes of limitations? I think that we should have a very thorough discussion of statutes of limitations, when they should apply and when they shouldn't. What would happen is here we would be putting in something that, for instance, my understanding of this is that if I was abused when I was, let's say, 10, I would have till I was 24 at least to sue, and that's okay. And even though I didn't repress it, I could say that when I was 30, I just realized that even though I'd known about it since I was 15 and known about it all the time, I could then sue and say, because now when I'm 30, I think that caused my drinking problem or something, if I have one. So then I could collect for that, I believe, and then I could decide when I was 50, this caused my relationship to be with my parents bad.
Can you speak to specifically? We're running out of time. Can you speak specifically to his request for whether you would hear the bill or not? I mean, we could debate the merits of this for the next half hour, and we're out of time. He asked you a question of whether you'd hear it or not, and I guess I'm not hearing you. You're saying it's complicated, but do you want to give him a yes or no, or can you give him a yes or no? Or you want?
I don't know how I can give him a yes or no. I don't know where I'd find
the time
to do what should be done on something like this. I happen to believe that we should do thoughtful processes when we change the law on important things. Maybe I've been an attorney too long, but I don't think the legislature should be screwing up law with just on a whim. And
Representative Simon, do you want to respond?
I would just say, members, if you don't like the bill and you want to kill it, send it out of here. If you think that you get more of a chance for more debate, vote no on the amendment. It's dead if it goes out of this committee. And that may be what people want, but I'm just saying that for practical.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, I will vote for the re-referral, and it has nothing to do with whether I want to kill the bill or not. And there was a mention about the integrity of the legal process. I'd like to think that we have some integrity of the legislative process. I do not believe that making a policy bill within a finance committee without the policy ever being heard in the policy committee does anybody any good, Representative Simon. Representative Simon, if this piece goes into the finance bill to the House floor without ever being heard in the policy committee, you can bet we're looking at about a 16-hour debate and the threat of the entire policy bill because of this provision never even having been heard in the policy committee. So I'm going to vote for the re-referral, but I don't think it's appropriate to say that anyone who does is going to kill the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Simon.
And that's a fair point. I guess I would just say to members, I've tried to do it the right way with another bill and Representative Mullery, and he has a principal position on this. We happen to disagree, but I respect his opinion. And as I told him when I met with him, I'm not trying to change his mind. He won't hear the bill, either the original one or this one. It's just not going to happen. So, take that for what it's worth. That's just the reality. I want to be straight with folks.
Similarly, then we're going to vote.
Chair Paymer and Representative Simon, I just want to make it clear I am a co-author on this bill, but I'm going to vote for the re-referral just simply because I I just would like to have more discussion. But I want to commend you for bringing it forward and the others that have come forward today. And I do hope and I do expect that we will have discussion on this matter. So thank you for bringing it forward. And but I am going to vote for a re-referral. Thank you.
Okay, members, just to understand the process, this bill came to the Finance Committee. It was referred here. You can take it up with Representative Carlson about that. It was posted. It could have been
referred. Mr. Chairman, to that point, I talked to Representative Carlson last night as to why it was referred here, and he said because he didn't know it had policy in it.
Well, then, there's been some bills that have come here and come to your committee that is sort of a fine line whether it should have gone to either committee, but we have a motion on the floor. You get the last word, Representative Simon.
I would say I'm only in my second term, but my observation is that there are many, many provisions in finance bills that have policy to them. That's just my observation, and I don't agree it's going to grind the place to a halt, nor do I agree that it's somehow unconstitutional, nor do I agree it means a 16-hour debate. I just happen to disagree.
Thank you, Representative Simon. Thank you, members, for hearing the bill. Representative Coles has moved to refer House File 2134 to the Public Safety Policy Committee. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
Motion prevails. Is there any other business before the committee? All those in favor? Oh, no. There is no more voting. This meeting's adjourned.